Welcome back to Global Girl Media UK's podcast. This episode, we have the privilege of chatting to one of my and Holly's favourite journalists, Bethan McKernan. Bethan is a Middle East and Turkey correspondent who has reported on incredible stories for The Guardian, one of the UK's biggest national papers. Since International Women's Day falls in March, we wanted to commemorate this day by speaking to Bethan about her experiences as a woman, not only in journalism, but also as a woman reporting from war zones. But before diving into the complex issues, let's start from the beginning. How did you get into foreign correspondence?
Hi, thank you very much for having me and for very kind words there. How did I get into foreign correspondence? I guess I always wanted to do it, even before I really knew what the job really entails or what it meant. I always wanted to travel and I always wanted to write. And as you know, it can be quite a difficult field to get into. So I had a desk job in my mid-20s on the website of The Independent, and there was a New Year's Eve. I basically promised myself that night, I thought, right, do you know what? This is the year that I'm actually going to do it. I know it's going to be difficult and I might need to save up a lot of money and go freelance, and that's quite unpredictable and can be quite unstable, but at least I've got to go try it and see what happens. So my boss says that I wanted to move to Lebanon because I've been learning Arabic for about 2 years at that point, and I wanted to actually start using it a bit. So I told them I was going, and they said, oh, all right, well, you know, you can report for us from there if you want. So I actually got lucky in that respect, and I went with, you know, some work already lined up.
Well, that sounds incredible. That's a New Year's resolution that's worked in your favour then. What about your education journey as well? Did you always know that you wanted to go down the path of journalism? And if so, what do you think is important for our younger listeners to kind of be aware of when they're considering further education or like further experiences to broaden their journalistic experiences, of course, and specifically for foreign correspondents?
I think a lot of trying to break into journalism or UK journalism at the moment is it's really difficult, and a lot of it is who you know, and you know whether you have a family who work in the industry and friends who work in the industry who just to give you a kind of even baseline understanding of how it works. Those are the kind of things that you can't really control for if you want to break into a media job. And I didn't really have any of those things. I guess, you know, if you're still sort of like at the later years of school or you're at uni or something, and this is what you want to do, I would 100% say if you know any other languages or you're interested in learning foreign languages, that's 100% the most useful advice I could say to anybody who wants to get into journalism, because, right, you can report on stuff that other journalists in a newsroom can't necessarily. So that would be my first piece of advice. And my second would be, is just to know that you have to really be able to take knocks and to get up and keep going again and again and again if you want to succeed in it. It is really tough. And things like unpaid internships are cruel and they don't really work for, you know, normal people. But if you do have a break in the school holidays or uni just to go down to your local paper, even just for a couple of days, and ask them, you know, how do you do what you do? How do you put stories together? How do you find them? You know, it helps you understand how this stuff actually works. So you don't need to do, you know, 3 months in a newsroom fetching coffee or whatever. that's not useful. You'd be learning way more and doing much more hands-on stuff if you kind of start really local, where people actually have the time to show you what they're doing, and you know the area, and you know what the stories are. So you probably find that you'll learn a lot more there than somewhere else.
That's great advice, very valuable as well. And you've also answered my other question, which was, do you think it's important to know the language of the country that you're reporting from?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've been learning Turkish for 2 years now. Dila, Türkçe biliyor musunuz?
Türkçe bilir miyim?
Evet.
Ben Türk'üm. Türkçen iyi.
Ben de biraz Türkçe biliyorum. Like a Welsh Turkish accent. Yeah, this is why everybody thinks I'm really funny. I set out to report, I was interested in the Arab world. I went to Damascus when I was 19. I had this Syrian friend that I worked with, and this is before the Arab Spring. And I had, you know, I'd saved up a bit of money and I wanted to travel before I started university, and I didn't have any idea where to go or what to do. And she said, well, why don't you go to Syria? You know, it's really great and there are cheap flights. This is back when I think BMI Baby or one of those carriers still existed. Wow, I feel old talking to you guys. So yeah, I did. I went for a couple of weeks to Syria, to Lebanon, to Jordan and to Egypt. And I had a fantastic, fantastic time. And I didn't really know anything about the Middle East or the region before that, but it kind of got me hooked. And that's always been kind of there for me. So yeah, I decided to take Arabic seriously while I was living in London. Don't get me wrong, I'm still not very good because it's a lifelong process and Arabic is very, very difficult. But that was the intention. So when I moved to Turkey for the job I got with The Guardian, that was a whole new set of, you know, challenges. So I'm still trying very hard in Turkish, but it's very rewarding to actually start understanding things and to be able to have conversations with people and pick up the slang and pick up cultural references and stuff. So yeah, I mean, I would say it's super important to know the language of the country that you're living in or covering, but I also have to caveat that with, you know, I'm still learning.
You spoke a little bit then about being a woman and in a patriarchal environment. How do residents and politicians treat you as a woman and as a journalist in those kind of areas?
I think it's kind of a double-edged sword, because in some ways when you're a woman, if you're in an actual active conflict zone, like if you're in parts of Syria or Iraq or Yemen or somewhere like that, sometimes I find that the men that you're dealing with who are in official roles or military roles, they can underestimate you and they treat you like you're stupid. And if that means that they tell you information that they would never have bothered to tell a man because they're not trying to impress them or they don't think that you're going to do anything with it, then that can work to your advantage. You can get closer to people and stories than men can a lot of the time. And you can actually, you know, shed light on stuff that doesn't go into sometimes the reports that men put out. I mean, there was an example of this on my last trip to Yemen, which was in November. There's a migrant trail that comes up through the Horn of Africa, Ethiopians and Somalis who cross into Yemen trying to get to Saudi Arabia. And it's really undercovered because, you know, access is so difficult. And it's because these people aren't going to Europe, they don't really create the same kind of interest or headlines that you know, the refugee trail to Italy or Greece did. But yeah, you know, and I was talking to some of the young women and the girls who are making this journey, who the men, you know, a male journalist couldn't talk to or wouldn't be able to talk to. And their experiences are very specific and very different, right? I mean, I ended up writing in my report that how palpable, you know, the threat of sexual harassment and assault and rape is for these girls. And I noticed in reports that, you know, men have put out about the same subject, that's just not mentioned in it at all. When to me, that's one of the most important parts of that story. You know, that's a whole 50% of the people doing this journey, you're kind of not communicating their experiences and some of the worst things that are happening. I think in that sense, we do bring a perspective and we do kind of make sure that some perspectives are told that maybe would get missed out otherwise.
Do you find yourself with like a certain affinity towards women and girls alike in like war zones or places like Yemen? Do you find that you prefer to speak to them and tell their stories?
Yes, definitely. Yemen is one of my favorite places to work, which I know sounds really strange, but because there is basically so little reporting that comes out of the country, and because, you know, Yemeni journalists themselves are often hamstrung in what they can report because they have to keep themselves safe. And getting in is really difficult. So if you are lucky enough to get the access and to actually talk to people, I think it's really important to convey what, you know, particularly Yemeni women have to say, because you don't get those voices. Even Even in the most recent round, I mean, there is a peace talk process for Yemen. And there is, you know, this sort of subcommittee dedicated to women's rights and women's issues. But even their male colleagues don't necessarily pay attention to them or give those issues the kind of real attention that they deserve. So, yeah, I think definitely it's really important to elevate those voices if you can.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting what you said about how maybe being a woman helps you in a way get more information for your stories. So I wanted to ask, how do you go about getting those stories in the first place? Is it by speaking to people on the ground, or do you follow recent developments, or do you like choose your own stories, and how do you approach these?
When I'm looking for stories or covering for stories, I think there's usually a combination of factors that go into that. Sometimes, you know, the news happens and it's so big and huge that, you know, it's obvious that you have to start covering it or looking for information or angles. I mean, to give an example, something like when Qasem Soleimani was assassinated last year, you know, I sort of woke up to those news alerts and it was just so massive that you had to start working immediately. So sometimes it's really clear what the story is. Sometimes I start with a topic. No one's really written about environmental issues in Turkey or mining, you know, new mining contracts with foreign companies in Turkey. That's an interesting topic. But to get from a topic to an actual story takes quite a lot of work. You have to sort of do a lot of reading on the topic and talk to a lot of people to figure out, you know, what the actual story is, you know, if there's any information that you can uncover that is new and that deserves to be in the public sphere. So, yeah, that process can take a little while, but usually it's pretty worth it.
This leads to my next question, actually, since you mentioned Turkey as well, also in reference to Yemeni journalists. Many people might not know, but Turkey has the second highest number of journalists which are imprisoned in the world. There are examples, like in 2015, one of the editors for the Cumhuriyet newspaper was imprisoned for 27 years. He was just publishing incriminating articles about the government, and he was labelled as a terrorist. So what I'm trying to say is there appears to be this silencing of journalists in Turkey and in the Yemen, especially when it comes to any subject matter that paints the government in a bad light. Does this make you reluctant to write objectively and for a UK national paper as well?
That's a really good question. This bit's off the record. Back on the record. Turkey has been a real learning curve. I think it's one of the most interesting places to be a journalist. But as you say, Dila, it can be one of the most difficult and one of the most dangerous. And, you know, and it's a place where you think, oh, Turkey, you know, Turkey's practically Europe, or parts of Turkey are very European. So it can't possibly be that repressive or that difficult to do free and fair reporting, but actually, yeah, it really is. And the trajectory isn't good either. It gets more difficult all the time. And this is something I didn't have when I lived in Lebanon. In Lebanon, as long as you're not writing about Hezbollah, you can basically write whatever you want, which is basically the consequences of Lebanon being a failed state, which is also not a good thing. But yeah, just to illustrate how different the situation is. It is very difficult. I've been living in Turkey for 2 years, and you need to be able to work there, you need to have a press card issued by the Turkish presidency. And I actually struggled to get one for a long time because the Turkish authorities didn't really like me and they didn't really trust me. So I think it's definitely been a learning curve and a balancing act, how you can write about the things that are going on in a state which doesn't necessarily like journalism, that doesn't toe the government line. You have to be very aware, basically, with every single story you publish. You have to think, you know, 8 steps ahead. If I publish this, then what will happen? You know, what will that mean? Will it mean that I don't get access to this thing in the future? Will it mean that my Turkish sources will stop talking to me because they don't like it? Will it mean that I'll get kicked out of Turkey? So all those things are always, you know, at the back of your mind, and you have to keep them quite. You have to think, yeah, you do have to be careful, but at the same time, you have to write it like you see it. And if they don't like it, then they'll kick me out. That's how it will go. So We will see. I mean, I'd really hope that that isn't the case. But I mean, this is the problem that everybody runs into if you're trying to do independent work in the Turkish context, is you're going to piss them off, basically. And they might have their reasons for that. And they might say, oh, okay, well, but this is our side of the story. And, you know, Turkey always gets such a bad rep in the international media. And that's kind of true. But I think as long as, you know, you can show that you have thought carefully about all the different angles of the story, and you've still gone ahead and written it anyway, even if it's not favorable to the Turkish government, then I would hope that would be enough to, you know, just to justify what you're doing. That was a very convoluted answer, sorry, but it is a very difficult topic.
That's quite interesting. I assume that if you were writing for a UK national paper, they might have been a bit more lenient. But I guess, I mean, they do care about how they present themselves, especially to Europe. So it makes sense, I guess. Okay, well, since you've been living in Turkey for the last 2 years, I want to ask you how you've experienced like the division happening in Turkey in terms of like the liberal younger generation against the older generation who are kind of adopting Erdogan, which is the conservative leader's backward policies. First of all, do you find that to be true? Do you experience this division firsthand through the last 2 years that you've been there?
Turkey is a really, really fascinating place. Mainly because of these kind of tensions, political tensions, and the polarization that you just mentioned. It's sort of, there's no kind of middle ground. There's no kind of consensus building in the middle where everybody kind of tries to come together and see each other's points of view necessarily. It's just, you know, extreme left, extreme right, extreme nationalism, extreme anti-nationalism, you know, whatever the topic happens to be, like everything kind of descends into culture wars at some point. So yeah, I definitely have seen those divisions really, really up close, to the point where actually in kind of conservative neighborhoods of Istanbul, sometimes people, I mean, I'm obviously a foreigner, right? Even though I can speak some Turkish, but sometimes people will shout at me or be like, go home or get out. You know, you're just spying for Western countries. When all I've done is like walk down the street with my headphones on. So I'm not trying to attract attention or talk to anyone necessarily. So it can be in some ways really hostile. Yeah, that's something I haven't experienced anywhere else except Turkey. It's interesting how there is this kind of the democratic structures and that kind of political plurality is, you know, that's part of modern Turkey. It's been there for 100 years. And even though, you know, the current government is definitely very much in control and has been trying to, you know, consolidate control very much so in the last 5 years since the coup attempt, there are still these kind of currents of you know, resistance or opposition parties that will work together to try and win an election, a local election result, something like that. So yeah, it's really dynamic and it's always changing, which I think is really interesting. Right now, well, I guess last month, there has been this new wave of protests in Istanbul and also in Ankara over the government trying to appoint a rector at one of the most prestigious universities in the country. It's called Boğaziçi University, on the banks of the Bosphorus in Istanbul. And that has, you know, really exposed a lot of divisions that were probably also there before Erdogan and the current government too. But it's been really interesting to see that there is this young, Turkey's a young country, right? It's the population skews really, really young. And all, I think there's going to be something like 2 million new voters by the time of the next election in 2023. Do you know, I think it's actually 5 million. I think there's going to be 5 million new voters if they hold elections in 2023 as is scheduled right now, which is a huge new demographic of people. And yeah, you know, all the evidence is basically pointing towards the fact that, you know, these young people are, they accept, you know, Erdogan's government and the AKP, like his party, as the status quo. They don't remember what life in Turkey was like before Erdogan came along and really, you know, raised living standards for the working class. And, you know, he was a real proper man of the people, like a real populist, not like the populist we have in Boris Johnson. Erdogan is like the OG. He really did, you know, put Turkey on a path where he kind of dragged it into the future. I think when Erdogan became prime minister back in 2002, 2003, The average life expectancy for a Turkish person was the same as the average life expectancy for a Syrian. And now the average life expectancy for a Turkish person is the same as for a Spaniard. So in 20 years, he's basically managed to like totally transform the country, you know, economically, politically, socially. And for some people, for his base, that works out really well. But, you know, for this growing group of young people, they don't know anything different. They think that's the project to rebel against. So I'm really, you know, interested and excited to keep covering that in the next few years. I think it's really important.
I mean, it does seem incredibly fascinating to oversee this adoption of the status quo, as you say, but also generates hope for the future of Turkey, or I hope it does anyway, because especially as someone who wants to live and study in Turkey, obviously witnessing these incredible protests and backlash from afar, and even hearing from friends who have visited Turkey and have observed the militancy of the police and such, like seeing people getting arrested or beaten merely for filming a video during a protest, it's understandably unsettling and really does show the stark differences between us in the West and conservative Turkey, especially since some of us are under the impression that it's such a liberal and modernized place.
I mean, Turkey is a conservative place, as I'm sure you know. It's a deeply conservative place. And I think a lot of Europeans and a lot of visitors who come on holiday, you know, they see Istanbul and how liberal it is and the beautiful parts of the Mediterranean coast and the Aegean coast. And they think, yeah, you know, Turkey is it's so liberal and so forward thinking and it's so gay rights friendly. And Erdogan is, you know, he's just a bad guy repressing everybody. But yeah, the truth is, it is definitely a lot more complex than that. Like, yeah, Istanbul is a liberal metropolitan hub in some neighborhoods, but in other neighborhoods, it's really deeply conservative, both, you know, politically and religiously. So you can have like a gay friendly nightclub in one neighborhood and then you can go 500 meters and be, you know, basically amongst, you know, really socially conservative people who would never, you know, those two things kind of go up against each other, which is what makes Istanbul such an amazing place, but also gives it all these tensions, right? I mean, I found moving to Turkey quite a shock and I thought I was ready for it and I knew what it was going to be like. But even then, the kind of the divides and the political kind of fervor with which people really believe in these different ideas really kind of shocked me. Everything is politicized, everything, absolutely everything. So yeah, if you were, you know, going to move there, I would hope, or if you're going to explore it, I would hope within a university community, you know, you'd be kind of, to some extent, they'd be able to kind of introduce you to what it's like in a kind of quite controlled and safe way. But yeah, there's no denying it's a massive culture shock. And you have to be really careful with what you say and what you put on the internet. That's one thing that, you know, I'm 31 now, and although the last year doesn't count because of the pandemic, so whatever. You know, my cousins are 16 and 14, and, you know, they're very much, you know, Gen Z. And, you know, I just see how they post stories and they're on TikTok and they do all this stuff. And all I can think is like, wow, how lucky you are to live in a country like the UK where you don't have to worry about, you know, people seeing what you think and do on your social media. I mean, sure, you know, Facebook and China are probably taking all your data, but at least, you know, that's not going to land you in jail. But if you are a young person in Turkey, you know, you don't have that freedom. And I think that's a huge shock to people when they first arrive, when they travel, or if they come for a little while, is yeah, it's heavily militarized, basically, like you say. There's no, you can't even hold a International Women's Day protest anymore. The one last year got shut down by police with tear gas and riot gear. The government would say that's partly a security thing because they did have a string of really nasty terrorist attacks through and the coup, you know, through 2014 through to 2018. You know, it was really dangerous in a lot of Turkish cities. So it's part, the militarization is partly a response to that. But yeah, it has this other effect, which the government is clearly very aware of making sure that people know they can't even gather in a group anymore, even for a peaceful march or a peaceful protest. It's just not tolerated at all. So between that kind of, you know, real life physical repression and then the online self-censorship, you know, those are really powerful things in shaping how what people do and what they think and how they interact with each other, which, yeah, I found quite difficult to adjust to, and I'm sure a lot of people do.
Yeah, I mean, it just is so evident that we're living in a time where certain politicians like Erdogan are kind of, the repercussions are like few and far between, I guess. And one of my examples I'm going to bring forward, and I know you've reported on, is the Erdogan's like violation of international rules and like UN resolutions to reopen the Kapalımarış in North Cyprus. Would you mind like really briefly explaining the situation and tell us what you think about this reopening?
Well, I think you're probably better qualified for that than me.
More opinionated anyway.
Well, you know, that's not necessarily a bad thing. That's what podcast discussions are for, I guess. Yeah, Cyprus. What a strange place Cyprus is. It was my first trip when I went in November last year, I think it was. Yes, right before they reopened Maraş, Varosha. Maraş in Turkish and Varosha in Greek is, it used to be this beautiful seaside resort town in the 1970s where all of the world's glitterati used to hang out. And it was really, you know, it was like present day, I don't know, Monaco or something. And then when the fighting over the island broke out in 1974, is that right? Yeah, when the fighting broke out in 1974 between basically the Turkish residents of the island and the Greek residents of the island, this area became a militarized no-go zone, and Turkish military actually came in and basically bombed a lot of it, and it's now this really eerie ghost town, just, you know, this faded glamour crumbling resort on this beautiful patch of the ocean, and it's been off limits for decades because a lot of families who fled the bombing, obviously they still have the property rights there, and they want to take, you know, if they want, they want to either be able to go back to their properties and rebuild the area, or they want compensation for the loss of their houses and stuff, which is, you know, it's really, really complex sorting out every single family in this quite large place. So yeah, there were elections on the Turkish side of Cyprus last autumn, and there was kind of the shock result where the pro-mainland, pro-Turkey candidate actually ended up winning. So now everybody's quite worried. I mean, Dilo, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think everybody seems a bit worried that the idea of an actual resolution for the two sides of the island and actually making Cyprus whole again seems to be now, you know, further away than ever. And that was kind of really symbolic in Varosha or Maraş when the new president said that they were going to reopen it. And Erdogan and his coalition partner both went to visit shortly afterwards and had a walk around, and, you know, really was sending this really strong message that this is, you know, Turkish land, a Turkish project. And it kind of fits in with this quite belligerent or aggressive foreign policy that Turkey has been going for in the last 10 years or so. Erdogan, when he was elected, you know, his political party was part of this very broad coalition, and it was actually really liberal. It was pro-Kurdish rights, it was pro-LGBT rights, and it's only, you know, over time that it's changed and become much more conservative in nature. And going, you know, not just domestically at home, that's also been reflected in Turkey's relationships with its neighbors. So before the Arab Spring, 10 years ago, Erdogan was you know, he said his policy was, you know, I'm friends with all my neighbors, no problems with all my neighbors. And now he's basically got ongoing fights going on in Iraq, in Syria, with Greece, with Israel, with Cyprus, with the Greeks and with the Greek Cypriot side of Cyprus. He's also involved in Libya. Yeah, Turkey, you know, Varosha is, I think, a really symbolic way of looking at how Turkey kind of sees itself on the international stage these days, and how it sees its place in the world. You know, it doesn't really signal compromise or a willingness to look for peace if you're going to unilaterally take this area that's very special to a lot of people and holds a lot of painful memories and kind of say, well, we're going to do what we want with it. And if we're going to reopen it and rebuild it, well, that's what we're going to do no matter what anybody else says.
Yeah, it actually just does make me quite sad, because his just completely politicized move is actually sacrificing years of resolution between the Turkish and Greek sides. And I mean, Turkish Cyprus being kind of a liberal place as well, it's like bringing these backward policies that he, from mainland Turkey to North Cyprus itself, it's sad. And I just think he's acting like a puppeteer to one of his closest neighbors, like you said. I don't know, it makes me sad as a Cypriot as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, the Turkish Cypriot community, I'd never been there before, and I was really, you know, it is very liberal. You know, people there didn't really, you know, they saw themselves generally as very separate to mainland Turkey and to mainland Turkey's problems and politics. And yeah, there's a big argument, like you say, that in the last 10, 20 years, there's been this push to kind of bring Turkish Cyprus, you know, closer to Ankara and to kind of tie those two things together, when actually what they want and what their people want are really, you know, very, very different. And there's a lot of settlers from mainland Turkey who are kind of swaying the politics of Turkish Cyprus, right? They vote more conservative, which is kind of changing the political character of the island. It's not a good direction, I think, if you're somebody who's, you know, from the island itself, and you see it kind of changing around you.
I'm not looking forward to any changes that are going to be happening anyway. And I mean, the only hope I have is at least like the large mass of students that might migrate into Cyprus will hopefully keep the island young, I guess, and keep the island a bit more liberal, because they come from everywhere, like the continent of Africa, Middle East. I don't know. I'm hopeful, but I mean, we share the same belief that North Cyprus and Cyprus itself is a very complex and very fascinating place.
It is. It's a really beautiful and really complex part of the world. And have you thought about doing any reporting from Turkey or from Cyprus?
Yes, of course. I live in the UK now, but every summer I would go back to Cyprus apart from this
year.
Nice. Yeah, I do have plans for upcoming trips as well. But I would love to. I find it very fascinating to write about and research about and hear about.
Yeah, I think it could benefit with a few more voices coming out of it into international media. So yeah, that would be really cool.
Yeah, I think we've been talking about some really complex and interesting issues. So I thought to end the discussion, we'll go with a bit of a lighter question. And that is, what is the most interesting story that you've had to report on? This could be something that was maybe dangerous or heartwarming or just...
Ooh, most interesting. Wow. I think the one that's continuously really interesting is probably what happens to the women and children of Islamic State who are foreigners. They're not Syrian or Iraqi, and how they... What happens to them? You know, do they stay in these detention camps in Syria or prisons in Syria, or do they get repatriated home for trial or investigation or rehabilitation? Yeah, I mean, those camps are really miserable places. I've got to say, they are horrible. And these women are very complex people, right? You know, I used to think any Westerner who ran off to join ISIS, I used to think they must all be idiots, because who does that? You know, how do you look at that project and, you know, enslaving Yazidi girls and chopping off people's heads in propaganda videos? How do you look at that and go, yeah, that's something I want to sign up for on this really dangerous journey? You know, let's go for that. But yeah, the more of them that I've met, you know, men and women, the more I realize, you know, actually everybody's motivations and reasons for going are really different. You can't really generalize about this really large group of people. You know, we're talking about, there's at least 12,000 women, foreign women, still in these camps at the moment. You know, I once met a French woman, she was early 20s, a French woman whom... She was a medical student in Paris, and her husband was an accountant. And I just thought, well, how bad must your life have been in Paris? You know, how much racism and stuff must you have faced for you to think this is a better idea than the life I'm currently living. So I find all of that super fascinating, and it's never happened before, right? You've basically got like Guantanamo Bay in the Kurdish held part of Syria, but it's not for men, it's for women and children, you know, like little children who've done absolutely nothing wrong, and their governments are refusing to take them back.
On n'est pas radicalisé, on radicalise nos enfants, non, on essaie de leur donner une éducation comme n'importe qui. Ils connaissent pas, bon bah, le monde extérieur, par exemple la télé, l'électricité.
So one extremely heartwarming story, probably the most heartwarming story. I don't get to do a lot of heartwarming stories, to be honest, but one heartwarming story I got to do, I was working with a human rights lawyer and a journalist in Trinidad. Basically, there were two little boys from Trinidad in one of these camps, and they had a picture of their mum that they carried around with them everywhere, and their dad was missing. He took them to Syria when they were about 10 and 7, and now they are 15 and 12, I think. So yeah, these two little boys were basically, you know, on their own in one of these camps, and they had this picture of their mum, and they couldn't remember her name because they were so traumatized. But the journalist in Trinidad, you know, he went around the Muslim communities in Porto, Spain, the capital, and he found the mum. So we managed to, you know, we ended up getting the two little boys out of the camps. Their mum came all the way to Syria. She'd never even been on a plane before. But this woman came all the way from Trinidad to Syria to go get her little boys back and take them back over the border to Iraq. And now they are, and then from Iraq, they flew home to Trinidad. And now they are, you know, happy. Well, I mean, they have social workers, and there's still some legal issues with the family because the state is still kind of very wary about how they're doing and stuff. But for the most part, you know, these kids are, they're home again. And they're doing all the things and that they missed doing when they were in Syria, and they get to, you know, they have a little sister that they hadn't seen in 5 years. So that family has kind of been, you know, made whole again. That kind of proved to me that, you know, that could be possible for all these children. You know, it is possible to do that. And yeah, it's basically one happy ending, which doesn't happen very often. So yeah, I like that a lot.
It's been an incredible conversation, and I've personally learned so much, and I'm sure our listeners will have too. So please do check out Red Incredible Reporting, and we will see you again in a
Çok teşekkürler, benim adım.